You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and I'm delighted to be sitting with Mary Hogan Finlay, who is the author of a beautiful book called The Road Once Taken. And I had the opportunity to connect with Mary probably, it's close on nearly 2 years ago, a year and a half, 2 years ago. And at that stage, Mary had the book in, I won't quite say a draft format, but in a format that was not ready for total public consumption. And I was so impressed with the book when I saw it that I felt it was something that deserved to be shared with a wider audience, particularly because The Road Once Taken, it's going back to 1973 when Mary and her intended at the time, Páirc Findlay, decided that they would up their roots and head on the hippie trail. And the hardest thing I had to deal with when I dealt with this was that when I couldn't imagine Páirc particularly being a hippie, because I didn't. So it's particularly fascinating in that context to see that Páirc and Mary had gone as on a hippie trail, and they got an old VW camper, Volkswagen camper van, and headed off across Europe. And as I said, they were trailblazers in so many different ways. Well, they were not conforming to convention in their journey. The other thing that I was so fascinated with and wanted to make sure that I got to talk about, this particular road once taken was possible in 1973, but in 2026 would not be possible because of the political turmoil that has happened in the intervening period. So as a testament or as a journal of history and social history and a lot of other things, I think it is a wonderful piece of writing that certainly encapsulates a period in time. Hard to know if it was simpler, but it was certainly a lot more innocent. Mary, thanks for taking the time and letting us have a chat, and I hope I give a little bit of a flavour of some of what this is all about.
You certainly do. Mm-hmm. Yes. It was an amazing experience for us, and I think today, looking back, we were very fortunate to be able to have traveled as we did and as innocently, really, as we did. We basically took off and from the Miramichi in New Brunswick and from our home in Montreal at the time. And it was almost like the youth had kind of a cosmic connection to each other, that this is something that you could actually do. So there wasn't a lot of thought put into it. We left with, I believe, $5,000.
Which was a lot of money at the time.
It was a lot of money at the time. And we, when we think of it, $2,000 of that was spent to buy a Volkswagen van that Páirc had actually thought through, that having a van where we could sleep and cook would be able to help us with our accommodation and our food. So that was one of the ways that we'd be able to travel that cheaply.
Taking a step back, because I didn't in mentioning that, of course, you are from down the Miramichi and Páirc is from Dublin. So you have the Irish culture coming together, and you met, was it in Montreal that you met at, or was it in New Brunswick you guys met?
Well, we met in New Brunswick.
Yeah. And then you were studying in Montreal.
Yes, at McGill University. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this was, what do you call it? Do they call it this year? Your gap year or something.
It was. Well, actually, I went to McGill and I intended to do my PhD in clinical psychology, and then realized that they only had experimental psychology at the time. So I thought, no, I don't want to do that, and I was at a loss. And it was interesting. Páirc was flexible enough, because he was employed as an engineer, and he was flexible enough to say, okay, let's do it. And we did.
Right. When you say you had $5,000, to try to put that in context, in 1973, you probably would have been able to buy 50% of a house, if not 60% of a house, with that amount of money at that time.
Probably, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, you know, oftentimes when money is thrown around in the past, it's to relate it to something. You certainly would have bought a car for it.
For sure.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. A good car.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it was a lot of money. So when you guys decided to set out, did you have an end date in mind? In other words, were you saying we're going for 6 months or we're going for a year? Or was there a degree of flexibility about that also?
Completely flexible. We actually didn't think through how long we were going to be away, when we were coming back. It was open-ended, really. Yeah.
Yeah, highly intelligent decision. And, like, economically, or in the economy at the time, in the early 70s, were employment opportunities sufficient, particularly for Pádraig, that you could afford to kind of head off knowing that there'd be a job when you get back?
We certainly did. Pádraig was an engineer, and yeah, at that time I had finished my several degrees, and I had been teaching psychiatric nursing at the Clark Institute, and then I was moving on to become a psychologist. So I knew that when we came back, whether we stayed in Europe or whether we came back to Canada, that we both were employable for sure. And so that was a real security.
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. the security blanket in a sense that mm-hmm. I'm talking about. So the initial portion of the journey, of course, is in anything like this, how do you decided in advance as well what your specific route was, or was that just we're going to cover that part of the world and we'll figure out when we get there where we're going to go?
Well, we knew we were going to fly into to Europe, and we landed in Brussels, and then we moved on and we went to Amsterdam. And in Amsterdam we met a lot of overlanders, as we referred to ourselves as. We in fact didn't see ourselves as hippies,
right,
at all. In fact, with the others, the overlanders, we were probably seen as more conventional, as opposed to a lot of the others that I would consider hippies. And so when we were in Amsterdam, we met a lot of people who were traveling. So we got ideas from them as well about the route to go and so on. And we got maps, and Pádraig was the driver and navigated the trip, really. And so we, certainly going through to Istanbul, to Afghanistan, so these were highlights for overlanders. And we learned from them, some of them who had already gone, they were on their way back. So we learned from them the hot spots to go and to meet other overlanders, to where we shared maps, books, tips on things, and so on. So, but no, it was very free form.
Well, I know, and I don't expect an answer, but if you considered yourself conventional, I'd love to know what unconventional was. Or I should say, I'd hate to see what unconventional was.
When I saw some of the other folks who were overlanders, some of them hitchhiked all the way overland. They were quite into maybe doing different drugs and so on, and being, you know, taking LSD trips or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we never considered that kind of thing.
Okay.
So that's what we found ourselves quite conventional.
Right. So when you got overland and you'd decided that getting an RV, a camper van, would have been the most pragmatic methodology of doing something like this. The van you got itself had an interesting history, and getting it roadworthy had an interesting story as well. Like, you didn't go up to the Volkswagen dealership and say, we're looking for a camper van.
No, actually, we saw an ad for a camper van, and we found out that it was a butcher was selling the van, and he had used it for selling his meat, really, carcasses of meat and so on. But it was ready to close that chapter, and so we called ahead, and when we got there there was a lineup of people actually who wanted to buy the van, but because we had called ahead and got our spot, we were able to get the van and so on.
Right.
And so even though it was cleaned out, Parag then decided that we would get materials to build a bed inside, and then when we were traveling with it and we got to Berlin, we were very fortunate that we arrived. I think it was July 1st, where every year they put out things for free, so carpets and furniture and dishes and so on. So that's how we outfitted our van with kitchenwares and bedding and everything, really. It was wonderful.
And then you brought the van to the Volkswagen factory.
Yes. So
don't go near a dealer, go straight.
No. Porik was very careful about, we did not want to, he wanted to have the van checked out, and he did his research and he found that in Wolfsburg, in Germany, that's where the factory was. So off we went, and we stayed there, I think it was about 4 days, where we got a reconditioned engine in the van. And so that was an interesting experience in itself. It was almost like taking your automobile to a hospital, where they arrived every morning with their white overcoats kind of thing, and went to work on the engine.
Right. And mm-hmm. So that kind of gave you the vehicle to get you on your road. And I don't want to go into a travel log because we'd be here for weeks.
Yes.
But at this stage, when you guys started out, not only was it was unconventional in a number of ways, but at this stage you were not husband and wife either, and that was, as I understand it, given the context of the times, somewhat frowned upon.
Yes, when we left for the trip, both my father and Porik's mother, who was in Ireland, my father on the mare machine in New Brunswick, and they were very concerned that we were traveling and not married. And both being brought up as Roman Catholics, and especially at that time, for more conservative families, this was unheard of, that you would actually be traveling together and not be married. So we decided, and we reassured them that during our travels we would in fact get married. Now, in terms of how we would plan that or whatever, again, it was just a happening. We did not plan ahead. Now, we learned later that Porik's mother had contacted embassies in the different countries to see if they could locate a Catholic church for us, and she was going to let us know where we could get married on the way. In fact, it was a happening that we met some folks in at a wine fest in outside of Athens, and so Porik and this Irish gal that we met decided that it'd be nice to have a party, and so they consulted with me. What about having a party when we got married? And so from there we planned the wedding, and we were actually near Athens, so we found a Catholic church on an island because we didn't want to get married in Athens. And we were also fortunate that on the island of Tinos, there was a Catholic church, because as you probably know, in Greece, most of the, it's Orthodox Christian, and very few Roman Catholic churches. But on the island of Tinos, in Agape, there was a Catholic church, because the French and the Italians had been there, centuries before. And so we found a Catholic church, and we made our way to the island, and we were married there.
And you didn't want just any old wedding, so you decided you'd get yourselves a bishop. Or the bishop decided he'd come along, because there hadn't been a wedding in the church for a long time.
Yes, so that was interesting. So we were camping on the coast in a small, very small coastal village, and we did meet with the priest of this village, and who spoke French, so we were able to communicate with him. So we didn't know this, but they announced it on the island that there was a Canadian couple being married in this church. It had been 20 years since anyone had been married in this church. And so with the announcement, they brought, there was a priest to be ordained, a child, a little girl to be confirmed, and ourselves to be married. This is a big event, really, on this island. So so you ended up having a bishop, several priests, and so on, to officiate these three sacraments. So it was quite something, really. And now the other thing is that I had, I don't know where I got this idea, but I thought I would ride to church on a donkey and Porik on a mule, even though he's always said it was a horse. But and I had asked before with the villagers to have the donkey decorated, which in fact they did decorate the donkey. And so we rode through the village up to the church on the donkey and the mule. And I only learned later that that, in fact, was how couples getting married got to the church, because these were very narrow pathways. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, the roads were not wide enough, actually, for cars. So somehow, at some psychic level, I must have picked up that this is how it was done. And I wanted to do it like in the past, so that's what we did.
Now I know both your parents on all sides are resting easy, because at least you've legitimized the travel.
Yes.
You can now share a camper van. but I'm sure that must also have had potential consequences or challenges had you not got married in some of the other countries you've gone to, where very traditional values would have been in play. So arriving now as a couple that are married would have probably been more socially acceptable or culturally acceptable in some of the other countries.
That's right. Actually, when I think of it, probably in we lived in India for 6 months, in a village in India, and we were accepted there, and we became part of the community and so on, attended activities and so on. So the fact that we were a married couple, I think, made a very big difference. So that's mm-hmm. a really good point. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure the same in Afghanistan, because when we were in Afghanistan, we met with a lot of overlanders, and they and the Afghan people were very gentle, accepting people. So I don't think it would have been anything there, but certainly in India, it was.
Mm-hmm. So while you had the 6 months in India, was that on the way towards Afghanistan or on the I can't recall where
that was after.
After. So yeah. When you were in the stands, there were a few serious health issues.
Yes.
That caused concern.
Yes. So looking back, I think our illness was due to an experience where we were traveling through the desert. We hadn't prepared properly for the distance and to have enough food in our van with us. I became very hungry, and I asked Porik when we were traveling through. There were Bedouins, and there were big Bedouin tents, and one of them was like a cookhouse almost for the community. And as we were traveling with the windows open, a very hot day, I could smell the aroma of this amazing food being cooked. And so I convinced Porik, let's stop, I need to eat. So I went into the tent, the cooking tent, and I saw, I think it was about four Bedouin men around this big pot, and they were cooking, and I'm not sure what it was, some type of meat. And so they gave me two bowls of this stew, I guess, and a slab of bread, and that's what we ate. And it was a couple of days later, when we were in Kandahar, that I became ill first, and I don't know how long, probably it was a week, I was very ill. And then after I was almost unconscious, really, and I realized, where's Porik? And he had been visiting me before, and in fact, he was in our van, very, very ill, actually, delirious. And if you can imagine being in that van in the heat for several days and not able to get out. So by the time I was able to go and find him, he was in very serious condition. So he also then had to stay in this little hotel where we were looked after by none other than Hare Krishna women. They were took great care of us. And so we stayed there until we were both well enough to travel. Then later on, when we were in India, in Delhi, we did go to the hospital for Porik to be checked out because there were some kidney issues and so on that we realized. And so we were very fortunate that we had the help and that we actually survived.
Going back in time, I guess, in modern day travel, you wouldn't dare travel without insurance. Was that something that was either an issue, or was it just that there was, again, it was such easy going world that you were able to arrive at a hospital without any travel insurance?
You know, that's very interesting. I never thought of it till this moment. And when we went to that hospital, I don't think we paid anything for the services there. Porik was in the hospital and had examinations and so on. He was there probably for a week. Mm-hmm. He wasn't as ill at this time because he had recovered enough to drive there. And I lived out in the van outside and visited him every day. And he was well taken care of. And you're right, we didn't have insurance.
Yeah, and you couldn't do that now. And
no.
That's why, again, this whole chronicle is reflective of how things have changed, not necessarily for the better.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, and the fact, when I think of it, that I felt safe enough to sleep a woman alone in a van by myself at night there, and just visited him in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's quite something, really, when you think of it. And now, when I think of it, would I do that? Well, I had to be careful, but yeah.
Another thing, then, when you left here, you said you were going out with $5,000, and they were Canadian dollars. As you weaved your way through the Middle East, how did you convert your money?
Let me see. I think we actually went to the banks there.
Right.
Yeah. And we did check in with the Canadian embassies in every country that we went to, and we got advice from them about details like that.
Right. Yeah, because again, these are the kind of things that come upon you.
Yes.
In the wonderful planned trip that you had.
And actually, when I was going through my treasures for writing this book and so on, I found that I had portioned out. I still have all the money from all the different countries. So I have, you know, Afghan money, India, like all from all the countries. Yeah.
I assume it was traveler's checks you brought with you, or how?
Yeah, yes, actually.
Yeah, you wouldn't be bringing cash.
Yeah, no. We got traveler's checks done.
Yeah, because again, this is pre-credit card times.
That's right.
Yeah. And international money.
So there was a bit of organizing in that way that we had to.
Yeah, and again, we take for granted in the modern times that you can just go somewhere and produce a credit card, and that things weren't like that.
You didn't have credit cards, you didn't have cell phones,
No. You
had none of that. Yeah.
So then moving on from there, after you got your health back and you were working, you decided to head to India. I know that there's places in between, but as I say, so 6 months in India. What possessed you to stay 6 months?
Well, it's interesting. We were on our way to Goa, and we were going to be going to Goa for Christmas. And we stopped at a village in Udaipur, actually. It was a city. And we were looking at temples. And the sun was setting over a temple. And the monkeys were hopping around on the temple. And Porik, as he was looking, saw the sun setting. He said, "I don't want to leave here. This is so beautiful. I'd like to stay here." And so then we made a decision, because we're pretty flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Said, okay, let's do that. And so, unfortunately, we never got to Goa. So maybe we'll have to do that yet. So we then met someone in Udaipur, and they suggested that there was a beautiful village called Kalashberry, and we ended up going there. And we were hosted by a guru in his quarters for a while, and then we rented a house in Dalwara, which is just outside of the main village of Kalashberry. And we stayed, the house we rented, actually the rent was about $2 a month. So we didn't live in our van at that for that 6 months. And our food bill was 59 cents a week. And now this is mostly vegetables that we had. And I always said, although Pori frowned on this, but I always said that we were the poorest house in the village because we had a dirt floor. We did not have like the cooking area. We had like an open fire, whereas the other homes and so on, they had much more elaborate kitchens where they were able to make their bread and cook a lot of things and so on, and they didn't have dirt floors. So we had a very basic house, so I guess that's why it was $2 a month.
What inspired the end of the 6 months? What inspired to say it's time to move on? And
you know, I can't remember, and it probably was Porig thinking about finances.
Okay.
And that we probably should get back and get to work.
Right.
And so maybe it was that. And also, we wanted to go to Nepal, so we were looking at timing. And we want to also visit some other places in, like Benares, Jaipur, and to get to Nepal. So yes, yeah. It was that.
So was that before or after you were film stars?
We were film stars. That was way back in Turkey.
Okay.
And that was just after we after we landed in Istanbul. And Porik had a tendency to rest in for quite a bit of the day, and I would get up very early and wander around. So this one morning I got up, and there was a very famous shop called the Pudding Shop, where a lot of overlanders went, and they'd have breakfast, coffee, and so on. And I would go and chat with the folks. And there was this man who was having coffee, and he was a film director. I didn't know at the time, but he came over and asked me, would I like to be in a film? So I thought, that's very interesting. And so I said, I'll have to ask my husband what he thinks. So I go back to the van and asked him, and the director that stayed at the cafe was waiting for my answer. And so I convinced Porik that this would be a good idea. And so we were very fortunate because we were able to go. We went to through the mountains up to the Black Sea. We stayed there for a week with the film crew. We were put up in a hotel, fed and treated royally, really, and had an amazing experience of being part of this film.
And then went back to being itinerants.
Yeah, went back to being itinerants. Yeah. But you know what? We were paid $10 a day, and I remember we made $150. So probably we were there for like 7 days.
Or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So after you left India, and at this stage I take it you're starting to look west gradually.
Yeah.
So as you were wrapping up in India, and you said, well, you were hoping to go on to Nepal, were you at that stage starting to look towards this time that maybe we were getting back to civilization or normality or convention?
Not really, not me anyway. Right. I think Porik was thinking more about getting back to work and his engineering career and so on. I live in the moment, really. So being there and the cultures, like soaking it in, the beautiful people, the everything. So I just really enjoyed the moment. But Porik was thinking we better get back. So yeah.
And on the journey back, was it you stopped off to confirm to your mother-in-law that you had actually got married?
Yes. Well, actually, even though they were relieved that we got married, I don't think they told many people or showed photographs of the wedding, of us riding a donkey and a horse or whatever to the church. Yeah, so that they were pleased with the marriage, and they saw the marriage certificate and the rings, but they did not put our photographs on the mantle, let's say.
And ever?
No.
Oh, okay. They didn't have you pause for one for the next phase. Okay.
No.
So in arriving back then, you organized your stuff, and you had it shipped, as I understand it, so it was shipped from Europe back to Montreal. And
yeah.
You arrived
back. In the meantime, we ended up living in London for a year.
Okay.
And where Porik had an engineering job with Brown and Root, and I did some interesting things. I worked at a horse stable, grooming horses for folks who rode on the Wimbledon Common, and so we lived there for a year, and then we decided that we really did need to get back home, and we also had a dog that we left with my sister, and that I needed to get on with my career, my education, and so on. So, but we loved it living in London, and then I was very fortunate that I got what would be considered the Yellow Pages here. So I went through looking at ships and travel and so on. I just happened to open up to the Alexander Pushkin, which is a wonderful ship coming. It used to come back into Montreal, and they had one cabin left, and with the cabin you could bring a container. So I mean, talk about fortunate. For $400, we were able to pack all of our things, because we had a lot now. We gathered a lot on our travels, and we had, I think we cruised for 10 to 12 days, if I'm right. And so this was full cruising with dining, even invited to dine with the captain, and a real cruise back home. It was wonderful.
I had forgotten to refer back to one scenario where, as I understand it, you were operating as a mule, and that you may have transported some contraband material across international borders.
Well, that's interesting. When we were leaving the village of in Colossbury there, when we were going, we had with the caste system there, you have the Brahmins and then you have the Untouchables, and our servants were of the Untouchable class. And when we were leaving, we've gotten close to them actually, because they came. Brought wood for our fire, for cooking, and really took care of us. So the morning we were leaving, the man who had looked after us ran out with his arms filled with a beautiful, actually, sculptor's statue, and this is all wrapped in newspaper, and as a gift for us. And so as we were driving away, I opened it. And in this package was this little round ball of hash, and we actually, during our travels, we never smoked marijuana, hash. We actually didn't even drink alcohol out of respect for the countries we were in. And so I just thought, okay, there's a ball of hash. And so we wrapped it up, and we had it with the sculptures that they gave us, put it in the van. Then what was interesting is when we were traveling across the border into Iran, I think it was random checks, because they checked all vans to see if people were carrying, you know, drugs or anything back, and that they shouldn't be. And so when the officers were opening up our van and so on, I all of a sudden thought, oh my God, where is that piece of hash? And so Porik is talking to them at the back of the van. I fortunately was able to get in and get it. And of course, I had to put it in my person and snuggle it away. And we were kept there, actually. We were very surprised, but they kept us in the medical clinic for 4 days, and we had to undergo a blood test, urine test, physical exams, and so on. And I was afraid to put this piece of hash in the garbage because they would connect it with us. And I couldn't leave it in the van because if they'd found it in the van, we knew that you could be shot or put in jail or both. And so it was a very tense time. And because we were treated like we were patients in a hospital, so we had to, you know, wear gowns mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. So, I had to hide it away and keep it throughout that time and even throughout a physical exam by a male doctor.
You eventually, you did carry it across a number of borders.
I did.
And you disposed of it, did you dispose of it in Ireland or was it in London?
Well, this is very interesting. So we're back at my mother-in-law's in Dublin, and we still had this little ball of hash, and I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, at this time, I probably could have put it in the garbage in Dublin, but I didn't. And somehow, it must have fallen out of my cosmetic bag or something. And I do not know what happened to it. I have this image that the family cat played with it. But I never found it, and I'm not sure if my mother-in-law found it.
Well, if she did, she didn't tell you.
No.
Indeed. Mary, as I said at the beginning, and I'll say again, it is a fantastic read because... your writing style is so easy to go along with. It's a wonderful journey, and it was so enjoyable to be on the journey with you. I'm going to take a break, and after the break I'll play a little piece of music, and when we come back I want to talk to Porrick, because the book is also filled or rich in photography, and the photographs were taken by Porrick, and Porrick is a Dubliner, as we heard. And first of all, Harry, thanks a million for being here and being able to chat with you.
Thank you.
What I find, first of all, fascinating is that given the time, photography would have been very expensive. And to bring expensive equipment and to have it with you, all very well while you left Canada, when you got to Germany. But once you head out on the road, first of all, what equipment did you have? What was the camera?
Well, it was Mary who started me off in photography. She bought me an East German camera, which was a Praktika. And this was when there was two separate Germanys. So she introduced me to photography. And like many other things, it was very different. We didn't have cell phones and whatnot. So as you quite rightly say, it was celluloid and chemical development and printing and so on. So when we were in India, in the town near our village of Udaipur, there was a photo lab. And they let me develop my pictures there in black and white. They couldn't do color at that time. So I kept all these rolls of film, and then when we came back to Canada, I had more time, and I had a dark room in Fredericton in New Brunswick, and developed a number of the color pictures at that time. But it doesn't have the convenience of today. But that's good as well, because you have to spend more time in composing a picture, because you know there's only 36 films images on one roll, so you have to have to plan more.
So I take it was a 35mm.
Yes, okay. It was. Yeah, quite.
So purely from a pragmatic perspective, again. Did you then head out after you got the camera with a bag full of films, or were you buying on the way?
We bought on the way, but we stocked up, let's say, in Athens, because we knew that we would be traveling. I think we didn't buy again until we reached India and whatnot. So we had a lot of blank, roles.
Yeah. So then when you were in Greece and around the time of the wedding, and the word got out in some places that you were there with a camera.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, you had a sideline as a wedding photographer.
Oh, actually that was in India.
Oh, right.
Yeah. They have very, very colorful weddings, especially the Brahmin class. So we were invited to the weddings and as our wedding present after the event, I would give them photographs that I had taken.
And you were able to develop there.
Yes.
So again, you know, you mentioned it, and very relevant because photography, as I said, was expensive. So it wasn't the case of you would click the shutter randomly.
Oh yes,
because every photograph you could calculate was probably $2-3 or whatever, but you could nearly associate a price per picture.
That's right. The other element is, particularly in the Muslim countries, I have to be careful because in some Muslim religions there is a concern that your image will be stolen.
Right.
If you notice in Muslim art, like there aren't any faces or whatnot, there's a lot of geometric designs. And then there was some sort of candid films, like a goat being beheaded as a sacrificial goat, and then roasted and eaten and whatnot. There was a carefulness, let's say, particularly in the East, of what photographs that you took. But we didn't run into any big incident there, but we were respectful, let's say, of the environments that we were in. We were also very fortunate at our wedding in the village of Agapi in Greece that we had wonderful friends from Germany, from Denmark, from France and whatnot, who were Westerners who had cameras at that time. So they took a lot of the pictures of the wedding itself, which was very moving. And they got the archbishops and the priests and the confirmation and whatnot. And then going through the village after the wedding to the taverna where we had goats on spits there, but the villagers threw rose petals and rice at us from their balconies on the narrow roads and whatnot. So some of our friends got those shots.
So then when you got back, I take it that you would have had all your little cartridges of film ready for
development.
And over the period of time, I know when you would have been doing that, you would this book that Mary has written would not have been anything in the thought process. So when it came to Mary working on the book, was it easy to put your hands on the stuff?
Well, we'd forgotten them. I mean, Mary wrote the first draft from memory, and then she found a journal that she'd kept over 2 years almost daily, so that amplified and filled in a lot of the details. And then I asked her, I must have taken a few photographs, didn't I? So we go up to the attic and we find boxes and boxes that we'd forgotten about. And then I put them in albums, and then we selected some. So it was building up, I guess. And it was so nice to see those pictures, you know. Again, they certainly bring back memories.
I'm going to switch back to you, Mary, there, because when Paul mentions, and I forgot to mention, that you had found your journal, that helped you, I think, as I recall, it helped you to put names on some faces, because in your journal you had it adequately detailed that when you saw the pictures, you were able to correlate the pictures to the written record.
Yes, I had... as Parag said, I had written it, and I actually wrote this during the pandemic when I had actually time, extra time in my hands. And after I wrote it, Parag said, don't we have photographs? So in the bin with the photographs was my journal. And so I got the journal out, and I was able to add in things like, where we crossed in the different countries, the cost of things, people's names, a lot of things that I did not remember.
And they're the detail that brings richness to a book like this, that when you can put the names and the locations on that. The process, the photographic record, in the world we live in, celluloid doesn't deteriorate in the same way over or did it over time, or so when it came to reproducing currently, the quality and the color and everything else was as good as ever.
Well, actually, I took the photographs in, then I had to have them increased to pixels, high pixels, like 300, 360, whatever pixels.
Yeah.
So that was a big process in itself, and where I took them, they were able to analyze the photograph and decide whether they could actually do that with the photograph. So most of Porig's pictures that he took, they told me they were very good quality, and they were able to increase the pixels because I needed really good quality to go in the book.
Mm-hmm. So then when it came to publishing, you were able to find a local publisher as well.
Yes, it's interesting. So the first edition of this book, it was self-published, and it was done with a company in the States, the United States. But this time, I decided I wanted to have it published by a publisher, and also I had to find somebody that would be able to do printing with high quality photographs, because you can get a book published, but if you have photographs, it's a whole different deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to find Baco Publishing here because I wanted it local, and they had assured me that they would be able to do a good print job for the photographs.
Mary, in finding a local publisher, then again, the big challenge with publishing, as with any artistic form, is getting it out there. I know we had a book launch there. It was wonderful to be able to go along to the book launch. But the book is available in a whole load of different areas. If anyone wants to get their hands on a copy, where should we be directing people?
Okay, so I wanted to get into local bookstores as well. So you can get it at Singing Pebbles on Main Street, Books on Beechwood, and I have some copies at Octopus Books, and then on Amazon, CA and .com, mm-hmm. So Canada and the States, and recently reviews on Goodreads as
Excellent.
Well. If you want to read about it.
Excellent. Mm. All I can suggest is it is a fantastic read. It is a wonderful book, and I would strongly recommend it. And any feedback I've got from anybody I know read it has thoroughly enjoyed it, and it is encapsulating a period in time which, particularly with the chaos in the Middle East at the moment, is not possible in any way to even imagine that something like this would have been possible.
Yes, Osmond, that is so true. In the late 60s and the 70s we were in an era of innocence in ways of freedom, or wanting freedom. And Mary and I in Montreal, we sensed there was a time in our life that we weren't married, we didn't have children, we didn't have a mortgage. So can we take this, as you put it, a gap year? But we didn't know the year that we were getting into. And there's no question, it was spontaneous, it wasn't long-term planning, but one thing I will say, we had guardian angels looking over us, because so much could have gone wrong, and I think, as you've alluded to, it's impossible to do that trip today. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not. So we're glad we did it, and we're glad Mary had the old journals and the old photographs, and to bring back the whole slew of memories for us in that age of innocence, as I look on it.
Well, Mary and Pori, thank you both for allowing me to come and share the time with you. The book is The Road Once Taken. It's published by Baker Books. It's available, as Mary said, in a whole variety of locations. If you do a search on Google, I'm sure you'll be directed to the online version, but if you walk around the bookstores in Ottawa, you'll find it on the shelves also. And I don't think it'll be too long before it'll be on the shelves in some other locations. Thank you.
Thank you.